I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with our regular Saturday live stream, and our special guest today is Morgoth. Morgoth, welcome back.
Hello again there, Greg. Hello again there, chat.
Yes, so speaking of the chat, if you would like to chat with us, you can do it through a number of ways, but our favorite is DLive, because DLive is our super chat option. Or I'm sorry, not DLive. What am I saying? DLive, you can send tokens, right? Entropy is how you can send super chat donations using a credit card. And we very much appreciate that because it does help us pay our bills. So the banner across the stream gives you the information you need. Entropystream.live/countercurrents. Ignore that Cash App thing. They just deplatformed us. So yeah, we're back to basically being able to take credit card donations through Entropy. If you would like to send tips through Odyssey, you can do that as well. And we very much appreciate it. And we will get to all questions and comments, especially the super chat ones, in the course of today's stream. What I'd like to do is focus on Dune Part 2 for the first hour, and then we can open things up to just anything you all out there would like to discuss. So let's begin, though, with Dune Part 2. I was somewhat pleased that the Trevor Lynch review that I wrote of Dune Part 2 was the number one article at Countercurrents in the last week. There's a lot of interest in that movie. I don't know how it's doing at the box office. I haven't really looked at any reviews. I've looked at some very obviously fake paid promotional material masquerading as reviews. I haven't looked at Nerd YouTube about this yet, but I've just been going on my own reactions and the reactions of some people in my social media sphere. But Morgoth, I'm not sure what you think of this movie. And so why don't we begin by just getting your take on this, and then we can talk about what's good about it, what's bad about it, and the various reactions and the broader cultural significance of this.
Well, I wouldn't say that I hated it. And I think it's getting a kind of a positive reception from some of the big hitters on Nerd YouTube's actually divided, but I'll come on to that a little bit later, maybe. My own take is that I thought it was visually quite pleasing. I can't complain about that. And I didn't hate it the way a lot of people were. I also knew, I knew before the first part that when I heard they were going to make there was going to be a new big sort of Dune juggernaut coming along, I knew where they would go with the Fremen. I kind of expected that, because it's such low-hanging fruit for Hollywood to sort of offload their diversity quotas onto the Fremen. I thought there's no way you're going to get Sean Young as type actress playing what is sort of coded as Arabic and Muslim these days. But then I think some of the set pieces, I loved the scene where he rode the worm for the first time. I thought the build-up was excellent. I thoroughly enjoyed that piece. And even some of the battles with the spice mine machines, I got away with that as well. And then I think the big disappointments were the Harkonnens especially. The battle scenes I thought were kind of generic, where it's like ever since we had Lord of the Rings, you've seen these sort of thousands of men going into battles, all lining up in a sort of Nuremberg rally type scenarios. And I think like that was really impressive about 20-odd years ago when they first did the CGI. But now it's as if, well, yeah, we get it. Like, you know, it's not really particularly special anymore. Neither is just having thousands of men run at each other, like yelling out sort of generic battle cries. So it all seems to have been played out. And I thought where it did very well was when it focused and played around a little bit within the world of Dune. So things like the main machines and how they worked, where there was a kind of, it was as if it had like hundreds of little crawler, pincer, tentacle things on the front of it. And I thought, oh, okay, that's interesting. Like, I quite like that, because I can see how that would be used to kind of hoover up the space or filter it or whatever it was. And I think whenever you get into something which is specific to the world, it ends up being more immersive than when it's just a sort of a battle scene which you've seen so many times before. So when it did that, it was fine. And then for the rest of it, it kind of became sort of indescript for every other Hollywood movie that's out there in big budget. But it's still, when you look at some of the disasters that have come out of Hollywood in recent years, where fandoms seem to be at war with the studios, by and large, people seem to have given this a pass. I saw a Critical Drink. I had a video. I didn't watch it. I saw the title saying the June Part 2. This is all we wanted, or this is what we've been waiting for. But then I saw a thumbnail for Nerd Erotic, and it had like shiny sort of really up close and looking particularly ugly, and with an "oh no" in it. And I thought, yeah, it depends, I think, on their own politics. There's probably a bit of bickering going on, I think, over what they make of it. So that's my general kind of take on it. The biggest disappointment for me was the waste of Baron Harkonnen. I read your article just before there, and I tend to agree with everything you say in that article as well.
Well, thanks. I didn't hate it. Like the first movie, I didn't hate it either. I really like the source material, though. But I really did not like how Lynch envisioned the source material. When I first watched the Lynch movie, I was very disappointed in the Lynch movie on the first viewing, but then I grew to like it. I don't think I'm going to grow to like this. In fact, I saw Part One, as I guess it will now be styled, in the theater, reviewed it. I got it on disc and watched it a couple more times, showed it to friends who weren't going to sit through it in the theater. And it didn't grow on me. And so I was disappointed in it. I thought that this could be a great opportunity to present an essentially very reactionary and very complex and brilliant piece of art from the 20th century to a whole new audience. And so I was hoping this would be good. It's still producing, it's still creating a buzz for the original novels, though, and that's a good thing, because I think that some of the people who will encounter the original novels will leave those novels with new ideas and better ideas, I'm sure. So it's a good thing culturally that this happened, even if they've done it badly. Did they do it really badly? No, it's not really bad. I just thought it was mediocre, somewhat disappointing, and it does have all the stuff that we've come to expect from Hollywood, the race and sex swapping kind of stuff, the girl boss stuff, the girl warrior stuff. It's so old now, though. And a lot of people have just sort of got like Dolby diversity reduction that they can switch on in their head now and just, you know, filter out this static and enjoy the film as a story. Objectively, it's a great story. The things that I didn't like about it were, well, the race and sex swapping. I didn't like that at all. I didn't like Chani, the woman warrior, girl boss type. I didn't like that at all. That's not true of her. I didn't like how, I thought it was visually kind of an ugly, dull film. Both parts, honestly. I think deserts are beautiful places. And when you learn that he actually filmed some of the desert scenes at Wadi Rum in Jordan, which is one of the places that David Lean filmed desert scenes in Lawrence of Arabia, you're just astonished by that. You're astonished by the fact that this movie doesn't look anywhere as beautiful as something like Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence of Arabia is more than 60 years old. And apparently people today don't have the taste or the, maybe even the technological ability to do deep focus, fine grained, aesthetically beautiful desert photography I just don't understand that. They could have gotten so many cheap oohs and ahs out of the audience if they just goosed up the aesthetic beauty of deserts, and they didn't do that. And then I thought a lot of the interiors were kind of gloomy and dull. I thought the people who run entire planets and, you know, have galactic empires sure live in squalid digs, frankly. I didn't like the clothes and costumes for the most part. I thought that what Lynch did, and also what the second of the Sci-Fi Channel miniseries did, the one that was directed by this guy named Greg Yaitanes, what they did very well is they basically did the style of the Imperium and later Paul's Imperium. It's sort of early 20th century British Empire style, you know, the clothes and uniforms and stuff like that. And I liked that. I thought that worked. I thought that was very good. There wasn't any unity of style here or vision. It was just like sort of bubble-headed spacesuit kind of stuff and drab rags, and I didn't like it at all. So I thought they really missed an opportunity there. There were some new characters in this part that didn't appear in the first part, and I was really looking forward to them. I was looking forward to the Emperor. I was looking forward to Princess Irulan. I was looking forward to Fade Harkonnen. I also understood that this character, Margot Fenring, who's a minor character in the novels but hasn't really been put on screen before, would be there, and she'd be played by Lea Seydoux, who I think is very beautiful and has a gorgeous voice. And so I was sort of looking forward to that. They were pretty much all duds, though. I was not crazy about Christopher Walken as the Emperor, or Florence Pugh as his daughter, or this whoever he was, Butler, I think is his name, as Fade Rautha. It wasn't spectacular. It could have been so good, and it was just kind of dull. And then go ahead.
I was just going to say, I'm just looking at, I was really disappointed with Christopher Walken. I like Christopher Walken, and I thought, well, that's an odd choice for the Emperor, because you always get an impression that he's being ironic or somehow postmodern. Like, there's a famous video of him when he must have been about 60, for Fat Boy Slim or something, where he starts dancing around, and it's really, really well done. And you think, like, he's like this cool kind of, you know, New York kind of wise guy type of thing, who's always kind of breaking the fourth wall. It's a kind of in-joke with Christopher Walken. And this time he had to play it just straight. I mean, I was just looking at some pictures of Dune Part 2, and I clicked on where the Christopher Walken tab. And then by accident, there's a picture popped up where he's in Batman Returns as, I think he was like a corrupt mayor or something. And
he's a businessman named Max Schreck.
Yes, and he looks more aristocratic in that than what he does as the Emperor of the Known Universe in Dune. And what makes that so ridiculous is that the whole point of it is that it's aristocratic, so their sensibilities and their aesthetics are going to reflect that. Like, it will look something like, you know, pre-revolutionary France. There will be this pomp and ceremony. For the Harkonnens, though, like, I think what Lynch did great with Giddy Prime and the Harkonnens was that there was this kind of purely utilitarian, industrial kind of dystopia to Giddy Prime. And that fits with the Harkonnens. And then you can juxtapose that to the main emperor and the empire itself and the rest of the houses. And you can say, okay, there's something dark and sinister about this. This speaks to something which is unfeeling and industrial and anti-human, which will reflect perfectly on the Harkonnen. So you get that impression before you've even seen the Baron himself. It's got this ominous feeling for it. You don't like it. Whereas where the other, the sort of the Emperor is this decadent and kind of pompous upper class. So there is a distinction there between the two. Yet when you go to the Harkonnen world, it's mainly a kind of sci-fi setup. And then all of a sudden you're backing like Ridley Scott's Gladiator for a bit as well.
Yeah.
So it just doesn't have that. It doesn't feel sort of imposing and it doesn't fill you with trepidation when you're going to the Harkonnen's place. And then that's not even to mention like how stupid they all seemed. I mean, no emperor would entrust managing Arrakis to those Harkonnens as depicted in the film. You would always find somebody better.
Oh, yes. That's one of the things that Skarsgård, I think he's an excellent actor. I really loved him in the Andor series recently. I thought he was a wonderful character and wonderful at communicating intelligence and moral complexity. This Baron Harkonnen just wallows around in spa baths and smokes crack and sweats a lot. And he's basically playing the Baron like Kurtz in Apocalypse Now. Grouchy. But there's no sense that this person is intelligent. He's just grossly self-indulgent. But the wonderful thing about the original Baron in the novel is that he is this brilliant combination of grotesque self-indulgence and extreme shrewdness, but it's an extreme shrewdness within a very narrow band. And one of the things that's wonderful about the book that has never been adapted to screen, and I was sort of hoping it would be adapted in this one, is near the end, the emperor comes to Arrakis to put things right, and he sends a few Sardaukar down to test the Fremen. And he finds that these people are absolutely superb fighters. And he's wondering maybe if Baron Harkonnen is using this planet as a place to breed superior soldiers who could threaten his power. This is the way an emperor would think. He's a warrior aristocrat. That's his legitimacy. That's in his blood. And he is absolutely incredulous that the Harkonnens never considered this possibility at all. And what that's supposed to show is that the Harkonnens are entirely merchant princes. They have absolutely no aristocratic roots in war, right? They are the nobility of commerce, not the nobility of war. And they are completely deaf to anything connected with war, including honor, including all the things that you're shown they're into in this movie. He makes them out to be very fascist. And in truth, that's not the way it is. The Atreides are the ones who are renowned through the galaxy for their ability to inspire basically loyalty through honor. The emperor and the Sardaukar are known for this deep connection. It's a warrior band bound together through ties of affection and honor. And the Harkonnens have nothing like this. They are purely commercial beings. And so I thought the way that Lynch portrayed them as living in a hideous industrial factory, basically, was sort of clever. It's not the way that the original novel portrays them. You know, the Baron is very sybaritic. He's got taste. He likes nice things. But I think that what Lynch does is he really heightens the sort of lack of the part of the soul that responds to beauty, which is allied in a way psychologically with the lack of a part of the soul that responds to anything connected with honor. And so to try and present the Harkonnens as quote unquote fascist is just a total amateur move on the part of Villeneuve. It's just laziness. They're pasty white and they have shaved heads and they're supposed to look like skinheads and they have their Nuremberg rallies and their gladiatorial matches, and you're just supposed to think, ah, fascists, right? And that's not the image that is found in the original book. That's not the thinking of Frank Herbert at all.
Yeah, they all encapsulate like sort of how like anti-white archetypes. So Fade is like young, self-centered, and then sort of psychotic. Like he to the liberal mind, he's the one who'll read too much 4chan or and then go off and shoot a school up or something. Mm-hmm. And then you've got like, and then you've got like the big thuggish one, and then you've got sort of the fat, lazy sort of Rupert Murdoch type at the top. They're all sort of cliches of how a liberal perceives the white power or the white power structure or something, which he completely offsets with the Fremen, which, as I say, I knew where that was going to go. And then to top it all off, you've got Shani, which is the biggest, that's kind of the thing everybody's talking about, actually. Because there's a lot. It isn't just that they race swapped her and they made her a feminist. She even does a sort of Richard Dawkins routine where she starts to criticize the religion and everything.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was great. They introduced this idea that in the south of Arrakis, where they have a different accent, of course, there are all these religious fanatics and fundamentalists. That's the word. And I was hearing this. This is not in the original Dune novel at all. This is basically creating a division within the Fremen that didn't exist and turning Chani into a modern shit lib, new atheist type. Basically the kind of people who look down on poor white trash from the South. That's what they're talking about there. That's what they're alluding to, right? Yeah. And that's disgusting. It's lazy, it's anti-white, it's disgusting, and it's not in the books at all. They also invent a desert warrior woman of color girl pal for Chani. There's some Palestinian or Arab actress who plays her. And the whole purpose is just so they can bitch around together, basically, and be, you know, be feminists and be, you know, religiously intolerant and disdainful of their people. None of this is in the book at all, but this is the kind of women that they want to encourage young women today to be, which is sad, because nobody no man would want a woman, you know, a sort of ball busting, competitive, angry. At the end of the movie, there's a beautiful ending to the novel, which I find moving. A lot of people just find it flat. I don't understand that. I find it very moving. At the end of the novel, Jessica, who was never married to Duke Leto, turns to Chani and comforts her that she's never going to marry her son. And she says that, you know, basically he says, we may be concubines, but history will record that we were wives, will remember us as wives. I thought that was kind of beautiful. And it's kind of stoic at the same time. And she's noble about it, right? Well, this Chani pitches a fit. She gets jealous and she stomps away and she gets on a worm and she's going to ride out in the desert. And so basically her husband, who has just conquered the universe, now has to drop everything and run after her. And this is drama only in the online sense. This is dumb Instagram, TikTok, teen drama. But this is the kind of woman that young women today are supposed to be. And the very idea that your guy has basically conquered the universe, and now you're going to give him a shit test and demand that he follow you. It's just so ludicrous. You think, and of course, he'll do it because he's such a new male leader of the universe now, right? And of course, there's a whole bunch of stuff where she's teaching him how to fight and telling him how to do this. And there's a poster where she's standing in front of him with her dagger drawn. It's all crap, which is not to say that the Fremen women weren't capable of drawing blades and defending themselves. They were frontier women. I have many ancestors in my family tree, you know, frontier women in America who knew how to handle a rifle, right? This still doesn't change the fact that the Fremen are people with sex role differentiation and things like that. And they're certainly not feminists. There's this line where she says, "We're all equal here, men and women." That's total rubbish. That's not the way that they're portrayed in the novel at all. So there's just a lot of silly propaganda in this film. And it's not even subtle. It's just dumb. And that really offended me. And I get so tired of having my intelligence insulted all the time by Hollywood.
We can't, we're not allowed to have tragedy anymore. There's they should have actually bigged up the how in love the two of them were, which I didn't get that kind of feeling from it at all. But we can't have tragedy where, yes, we're deeply in love, you're the love of my life, but circumstances dictate that I have to marry Ulan. And you can be my concubine, but you'll never be with me in marriage. And that's it. Circumstances have dictated. Circumstances beyond my power have put us into this situation. We are not, the world and the universe isn't liberal. We can't just do everything that we want all of the time at a personal level. Sometimes you have to just be stoic about it and knuckle down and think this is for the greater good. This is how it has to be. And it's terrible, but that's it. And then you could pan in on that and you could say, yeah, this is sad. That's like this is the way life is sometimes. It is tragic. It isn't always a bed of roses, but a modern audience is so sort of infantilized that they can't do that. They have to have some kind of catharsis where, well, she's going to be defiant until the bitter end, you know, putting everything in jeopardy, stomping around, making a big scene, because she can't just accept that. It's almost like an entire change of perspective on the world where you think, yes, I'll just have to braze it out and be with him when I can, but I do understand that I've got a role to play and he's got a role to play, and this is the way it is. You can't have a sort of that kind of deterministic world, because the individual, and particularly the individual will of a young woman of color has to take precedent. The order of the universe will have to change in order to facilitate her freedom and liberation.
Yeah, and that basically sums it up. And it's so sad because, yeah, you're right. There's a tragic element to this. And how do you deal with tragedy? Well, that's one of the things that great literature shows us how to do. And I don't want to overdo it with Dune. I don't want to overpraise it, but I do think it is it's certainly one of the great science fiction novels. I wish that Herbert was somewhat better stylist. I wish that he was as good a stylist, say, as Ray Bradbury, who I think was the greatest stylist in science fiction, just an exquisite writer. I wish he wrote on Bradbury's level, but some of his writing is very, very good. And his world building is unequaled. He's an amazingly imaginative figure. So it includes important lessons about being noble. But nobility doesn't mean anything these days. Another thing about this movie is Villeneuve, his scriptwriter, the creative team here, they don't get the aristocratic at all. These people are just rich and mean. That's how they portray them, just rich and entitled and mean and snooty. And so there's a kind of world star hip hop, gangsta movie style understanding of hierarchy, right? So, for instance, Fade Rautha comes to Dune, Arrakis, and he takes over there and he chops up a few people and he knocks his brother Raban down and forces him to kiss his foot. It's just juvenile Yeah, it's just juvenile. This is rap music consumers' understanding of things. This is about on the level. No, this is beneath the level of a movie like Scarface, right? Or at the end, Paul has the Emperor kiss his ring. I almost vomited at that point. I'd sort of grown weary of reacting, but I really thought that was just an awful, crude, dumb touch that indicated that these people don't get it. And these people aren't trying to confront their audience with anything that they might not understand. So the vulgarization of aristocracy and that ethos, which is absolutely central to this novel, bothered me too.
Yeah, it did as well. I was a thought that just slipped my mind about the main just to touch on the equality aspect with what's supposedly the Fremen. That actually undercuts something very deep in Dune, where if you look at the lore more generally and over the span of history, like the point that he's making is that the decadent society will reduce humanity to a more primitive and brutal state, and all of these niceties will go by the wayside. And so there will be an evolutionary pressure where eventually you're going to have men, religious fanatics with knives in the desert, and there's not going to be any place for equality in that. And when you then, I mean, it's kind of overthinking it perhaps, but it is jarring that we can't even have that. We can't even have it where even in this, they can frame it as an unpleasant world. They can say, they can even put it in that way that, yes, you wouldn't want to live in this world. It is awful and depressing. Just look just look at the inequality. But they don't even do that. Even in dystopia, you have to have liberalism present. Even in dystopia, like you can't have a movie where, for example, the far right have taken over and everywhere's white again and all of these terrible things are happening. They can't even do that in a way because there has to be diversity quotas there. You can't have a dystopia at all without liberalism being there guiding the way, even when the universe is specifically set up to have a strictly hierarchical and rather brutal world. It still has to be there as an underlying foundation.
Let's look at some of the questions we've got here, and then we can continue. I don't want to miss anything. Dr. Martin Luther has sent us 25 Libri tokens. Can't wait for North American New Right Volume 3. Well, great. I'm glad you're waiting for it. I'm thinking about the contents of that, actually. Purcell has donated one diamond. Thank you very much. Gadius has donated 10 US dollars. Should British nationalists just speak in code from now on, perhaps use Tolkien or Dune references when referring to anything IRL, since there seems to be no freedom of thought, let alone speech in their country anymore? I'm not joking either. So maybe put up "It's Okay to Be Hobbits" stickers and stuff like that. What are your thoughts on this, Morgoth?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for the real world actors, but people online have been doing that for years. There's all kinds of coded language to get around certain things, which everybody picks up on. I mean, it's a little bit easier now than what it was, where everybody got sort of shit tested on the JQ, where it was always name them, name them, name them. And you can kind of, everybody gets it now. Everybody knows it's a little bit passé. You're not really the top guy because you're mentioning the JQ the most in a stream, for example. We've learned to do a lot with just implying things or leaving things hanging in the air. Or, you know, if you want to talk about Nazi Germany, you'll say something like the mid-century Germans or
right.
the Austrian painter, or if you want to touch on that at all, or you'll say there's certain ethnic groups in Hollywood or whatever. There's all these different ways that people have come up with. When you get in trouble is if you're going to be really explicit about it and campaign out in the open. The system doesn't like that. And the problem there is that I think that's when, if you're trying to reach normies walking down a shopping center or whatever, you actually are going to have to hit them hard. You know, you're going to have to say something like white's minority by 2066 or whatever it happens to be. It's a lot more difficult out in the when you're trying to communicate a message to the normies if you've got to do that in code, which is probably why the laws are so ridiculously strict in England and in the United Kingdom.
Dino is written in with $3. I read the Dune books decades ago, seemed more about culture and theology than sci-fi. I don't expect the films can convey this. Well, they are an interesting synthesis of sci-fi and fantasy novel tropes. In fact, when I reread Dune recently, I paid attention to how long was it before I knew that we were not in a fantasy novel, because it begins with an old witch visiting a castle, right? And it's like, oh, okay, what kind of novel is this? And then eventually you get, oh, there's space travel and stuff like this. It comes out, but there's a lot that's very much fantasy. And he's very good at the world building explanations for this. So, for instance, yes, there's a civilization that spans the galaxy. However, he has a case for why a civilization that could actually span the galaxy would replicate medieval rather than liberal democratic forms of society. And that has everything to do with time horizons, because in the Middle Ages, you had noble dynasties, you had initiatic societies, you had things like the church and various holy orders. These things could project plans in terms of centuries, whereas liberal democracy and capitalism thinks only in terms of quarters and election cycles. And there's simply no incentive to think any longer than that. Of course, people do think longer than that, but they tend to be marginalized because most people have shorter time horizons. And those people are empowered to make decisions. So you know, people are voting on stupid plans that will destroy the future all the time. And the people who say, but wait a second here, this isn't any way to run a society, they're just marginalized.
Mm. It's also that, I mean, last year I read the Butlerian Jihad and did a video on it. And part of it is in there, what they get into is that, well, okay, we're going to wage war on the robots and computers, artificial intelligence, which they purge completely. And then the Orange Catholic Order becomes the standard religion. And in there, it's written in that we never, ever go down that route again, because humanity nearly went extinct because of the robots, the thinking machines. But that does have consequences, because then it has to be, well, okay, we're not going to be able to, say, have automated crop growing, so people are going to have to do it. We're going to need to make people do that, unfortunately. Otherwise, the road back to the machine we're going to head back where we began. This is also why you have Mentats, who are sort of computer machines, the human computers. I mean, this was almost completely absent in the movie, by the way, which few people. Mm-hmm. Seem to pick up on. It's just some fat man who blinks a few times at the beginning, and except for that, there's the Mentats just hardly even exist at all. Or where the Mentats are made like is a masculine thing, and the Bene Gesserits is a feminine thing, and all of this just doesn't seem to be in it. It's the Bene Gesserit are, but the Mentats, for whatever reason, didn't seem to. The scriptwriters just didn't seem to be interesting. But the point is that it's a deterministic world, because you don't, as I was saying earlier with the Shani sort of concubine scenario, you don't have control over your circumstances all of the time. There's a reason why they've had to sort of make human computers. And there's also a reason why it's feudal. And it's because you need people at the bottom planting potatoes if you've outlawed all of the machines.
Yeah. And once you have the war against artificial intelligence, you're forced to develop human capabilities again. And that is very inegalitarian because these capabilities are not equally distributed. Whereas computers are great levelers. They're great egalitarian tools. You also, to improve the human stock, you have to start practicing eugenics. And this is what the Bene Gesserit do. So there's a logic to it. And it's a very illiberal universe because he's got a logical rationale for that. And very little of that comes in. One of the reasons why they run around fighting with swords, right? Why not lasers, right? Is that it's explained that the invention of the shield has neutralized the laser, because if you fire a laser type weapon at a shield, everybody will be blown up in the process. That's just dropped, and so you see these laser-like weapons being used. It's annoying because, and of course these beam type weapons did exist occasionally, but you'd be almost mad to use them in the setup. And so you're wondering, why are these people running around with swords? It doesn't make any sense, and it's not really explained. So it does make sense. So I love how Herbert creates a logic for a future that embraces many archaic practices and patterns. And so it's a perfect, it's archaeofuturism in the sense that yeah. Guillaume Fay talked about.
The wall e-world where everybody sits sort of obese in a floating chair and just consumes. Like June is what comes after that. June is post the age of non-scarcity.
So let's see here if we have a few more questions. Shambolix writes in with $10. Thank you. In Dune Messiah, Paul's holy jihad kills 61 billion people and sterilizes 90 planets. How will normie audiences get behind this? Easy. Make House Harkonnen, House Karina, and the Sardaukar whiter than white. Make the Fremen multicultural. Make Maul Paulu crusading utopian shit lib. Now fight for justice. Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. They're laying the foundations, and I'm sure there'll be a third movie, right? They're laying a white genocide scenario here. You can already see it in the way that the casting is done. They basically turned this into a war between pasty white and just white snobs and bad people and schemers and a multiracial, multicultural, ululating, jabbering, filthy rag-wearing coalition of non-whites and white race mixers. So basically, they look like Antifa.
It's bad. It reflects on something which I'm interested in on the like in the actual geopolitical situation that we're in now, because I know that was like we had a, like an interaction on the Russia situation. And I'm not a Putin fan, actually. I'm not a fan of the BRICS. I'm not a fan of this third worldism, because I don't believe they have any kind of empathy. I don't believe that Iranians and the Chinese are going to be our friends. And you get into this weird situation. And on a civilizational level, the West's in a bad spot here. And I don't want the West to sort of collapse into a heap either. The problem is we are ruled by people who are incompetent, corrupt, and stupid, and hate the native Europeans or the native stock of the West. And so the you see it with this kind of like a lot of people originally. If you go back, I remember when Countercurrents, there was podcasts back in the day when June was kind of rediscovered, and we were saying, "Yeah, this is great." And that you could almost slot sort of young white men into the role of Fremen, living under this oppressive sort of, you know, this oppressive regime and having that homeland occupied and everything. But there's also a sort of woke third worldist version of that as well, which becomes outright propaganda when you put it into a wider cultural context, wherein you have these people who are like out and out siding with the enemies of the West because they believe it'll bring down the West and all that. I don't actually think that's a good thing, because I don't believe that these other people are going to be very empathetic to us. I've never seen any evidence of it whatsoever. And so this is a sort of a tangent to go off on. But June actually, when you, from that perspective, June becomes or could become just out and out propaganda where everybody's cheering on this non-white revolution taking place, this mass genocide event taking place. And that you'll probably even have third positionists and third worldists in the nationalist scene cheering it on for what it is as well. And I don't like this. I don't like where any of this is going, to be honest.
Yeah, I don't like it either. Yeah, the truth about Frank Herbert is complex, but he was a man of the right. He was an artist of the right. I think that his vision is deeply reactionary. What some people find hard to compute is that he was very much into ecology, and he was very sympathetic in certain ways to anti-colonial movements. But there's nothing unrightist about that. I think that the true right can be both ecological and also anti-imperialist and anti-colonialist. So even those things that the left finds appealing really aren't leftist. Another thing about him is he experimented with psychological drugs. Oh, I guess that makes him a hippie. Well, I guess Ernst Jünger was a hippie too, right? It just doesn't compute. The things that the left want to appropriate about him, or the things about him that sort of served as protective coloration so that he could foist a deeply reactionary world upon leftist audiences, are consistent with being right on the right. They're just superficial about it. They don't understand this. It's very, very crucial, though, to understand the race projection within the Dune universe, within the novels. Everybody in Dune, I believe, is basically Caucasoid. He has a name, Dr. Wellington Yue. People think, well, that sounds Chinese, but there's nothing about him that makes him seem like he's biologically Oriental. What about the one character that I think might have a certain suggestion of non-whiteness is the character of Duncan Idaho, who's described in a way that may sort of hint at an American Indian strain in him. And of course, Idaho is a Indian name. But you can't even really say that. And it doesn't, not all of his traits fit that either. So basically, he envisions all the people in his novel as Caucasoid. The Imperium is definitely Europe. And the people of Arrakis, they think of themselves, they have a myth that they're descended from the Egyptians. So that would make them Near Eastern, right? There are certain Near Eastern cultural forms that are everywhere in the Dune universe. Things that are borrowed from the Caucasus, things that are borrowed from Arabia. He was very influenced by T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. Paul Muad'Dib is sort of like T.E. Lawrence going off into the desert and raising up an army of rebels against an empire, a corrupt, teetering empire far, far away. So, you know, there are things that are definitely Near Eastern about it, but it's essentially a Caucasoid worldview, a Caucasoid world, a Caucasoid universe. There are no blacks in his universe, as far as we know, but there are plenty of them in Villeneuve's universe. And the depiction of the Fremen is, they are basically, it's sort of a Middle Eastern, North African, African hodgepodge with a few people who look whitish. And of course, Paul, who's going to race mix with them. And so it does look like something very different. And it looks like something in today's context, which is Antifa. And beyond that, which is the global South arrayed against the white race around the world, the European race. That's a battle that we can't afford to lose. And this is propaganda, or shaping up to be propaganda against us in this battle. And therefore, this isn't to be trifled with. This is not an innocent movie. This isn't a game.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. When you bring in what's happening geopolitically, it's serious. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, Bollocks, let's see here. Okay. He writes in with another $5. If the Battle of Arakeen is akin to Berlin 1945, then the forthcoming Holy Jihad is akin to denazification, critical race theory projected across the universe. The audience may wring their hands at the brutality, but they'll reluctantly accept the necessity. Shambolix adds $5. Predictions for Dune 3. Chani Daya will play the cynic, but she'll ultimately bear Paul's mixed children despite the Bene Gesserit eugenic breeding program. Well, we know that. Paul will sacrifice himself to save them. This will be the moral crux. This will end the legacy of whiteness with Chana Daya's womb. Okay, yeah, that's basically what they're shaping it up to be. Let's see. Lovecraft has donated a ninjagini. Muad'Dib threatens spice production on Arrakis. Women and minorities most affected. Shambolic adds $5. The only good change at Dune is that timing has made comparisons between Fremen and Houthis unavoidable. Sadly, this will only fuel the Zionists or white colonizers' bad takes. This is good. I like this. Slog has donated 14 diamonds, or 14 lemons, I should say. Roger has written in with $10. If they are incompetent, how could they rule over us being competent? I believe they are the competent at what they are doing, which is to render the West powerless and white people impotent. The reason the incompetent rule us is they and the competent are ruled is because we have a moral code that basically says that the weak and the meek and the halt and the lame and the blind and the pathetic are to be prized over the strong and the competent. And of course, once you look at other races, that's just a recipe for enslaving whites to non-whites around the globe, and especially inferior non-whites, hopeless non-whites that really need us, like the cannibals in, not New Guinea, like the cannibals in Haiti, right? The very fact that we are superior in the minds of your average shitlib makes them feel guilty and in need of absolution. And how do you absolve yourself? Well, you give it all away, basically. That's what we're seeing here. So the root problem is a moral code that penalizes quality and rewards inferiority. And that moral code, well, it's certainly birthed into the world by Christianity. I don't know of any pre-Christian antecedents to that. And that's why there's a Christian question. Do you have any thoughts on this, Morgoth?
No, I agree. I agree, actually.
Okay, so Board Troll has donated 1 lemon. Thank you very much. Very much appreciate that. Let's pop over to our friends at Entropy. Okay, we've got a bunch here, so let me go quickly through them. Luke writes in with $14.88. Morgoth, can you read your Substack articles and put them behind a similar paywall on Odyssey? I can listen to them at work, but I can't find time to read them.
Yeah, I have to be better at doing that. I am trying to figure out, not just for Odyssey, but for YouTube as well. I did one recently, but when you get into the habit of writing, like the video editing, suddenly you realize how much you could do another article or plan out another article for that. But it is a lot. Yeah, it's correct. A lot of people are saying like they miss the videos. So I am going to try and get back on top of that this year.
Yeah, I've had the same experience. I tried to get in the habit of doing audio versions of things, but to do an audio version is as much work as writing a new article for me. And I am hoping now, though, I've got a guy who's working for me who's looking at various AI things. I know the Butlerian jihad is necessary, but in the meantime, I'm going to use this stuff. And let's not call it AI because it's not actually an artificial intelligence. It's just, this is the way that they're promoting their world-ending scheme by telling us that any improvement in the stuff that our computers have been doing for years is AI. Okay. So that's just a marketing technique, a way of marketing Armageddon and human extinction. But it's not actually AI, it's just improved computing. And there are improved computing solutions now that will basically allow you to clone your voice. So I can read sample words and scripts and things like that. I could read one of my articles, feed it into this machine, and it would clone my voice, and I could press a button and it would read all my other articles and it would sound like me. Now, there's some bugs with these things and they're rapidly improving, but this is the way that I want to go. And one of the things that's going to happen at Countercurrents is we are going to deploy this so that we will have audio versions of all of our new articles immediately. We're going to have several good voices, basically. And we're just going to have these machines read them, and it'll sound great. It'll be done in minutes rather than hours, or seconds rather than hours. And then we're going to have a plugin where you can go back and the literally tens of thousands now, there's got to be more than 10,000 things published at Countercurrents going back more than 13 years. Those many thousands of things, you can also just toggle a thing and it'll read it to you, create an audio version. So that's one of the projects that we're working on behind the scenes. We've got a bunch of important projects in the works. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, funny enough, I was looking at some pictures on Google Images of the June part two the other day, because I've always liked Charlotte Rampling, and she was very beautiful when she was younger. She's got very
motivated
eyes. And I was thinking, isn't it a shame, like the amount of budget they've got, they could even last year or the year before when this was being made. Like, I know it's a sort of whole subject, but I'm actually worried about AI filling up the internet with like just rubbish. But on the other hand, you can lean into the positive and you think, imagine if they did June, or imagine if somebody who's handy with technology in our circles did June, and you use the model of Charlotte Rampling when she was 25 or a young woman to be Shani. So the Zendaya, she just gets sacked off. We never see her again. And the Shani in our June would be Charlotte Rampling as a young woman. Or a little bit later, maybe she could be Jessica. And right. you could actually do all of these things. You can kind of toy around, and you could think, well, maybe we could have Orson Welles as Baron Harkonnen.
He was going to play Baron Harkonnen in the Hodorowsky version.
Yeah, I think that's why my mind went there. And you could have all of these things. You could just go wild with your imagination and bring in all of these. You could have somebody like Richard Burton in a role in there. I don't know what the regulation on all of this is going to be, but potentially people in our circles could do this. This is why Hollywood's terrified, of course.
Yeah, because then it makes me happy. It's afraid. I'm placing my hand on the brain bug and declaring it's afraid. So let me run through some of these other questions here. Okay, Bernie writes in with $125. Thank you very much. Very generous. He says, 1 year renewal. This is for your paywall. Excellent. Clarissa writes in with $25. Thank you very much. C writes in with $25. Thank you. Steve writes in with $50, just a donation. Thank you very much, Steve. Mr. James writes in with $50. Thank you, he says, and thank you right back. Johnny Boomer writes in with $35. Hang in there and stay strong, he says. Thank you very much. And the Sunshine Kid writes in with $10. Is Locke's conception of natural rights and the legislation and constitutions that are at least partially built upon it an essential ingredient of or an obstacle to modern day managerial regimes? Okay, that's an interesting question. It seems like the Constitution cult in the U.S. somewhat functions as a safeguard against the government. I'm going to need to think about this a little bit before I answer it. I'm going to set this aside. Just forgive me. Bear with me. Let's see if there's more stuff that's Dune-related here. And Rowan Woods has donated 6 lemons and 1 ice cream. Thank you very much. So I appreciate that. I have a question here that's a little bit relevant, actually, with the third worldist issue. So I want to go to that, and we'll return to Locke and managerialism and stuff later. Elsa writes in, what are your thoughts, gentlemen, on Aaron Bushnell? Do you want to take this first, Morgoth?
Yeah, I had a lot of pushback because I said it was a waste of life, essentially. And one person in particular really didn't like what I had to say, and he was saying this is going to be this great, beautiful symbol, and he has the courage of his convictions, and I just didn't buy it. To me, it just seemed like another leftist driven mad on love for the other, an empathy which he'd never get back. Apparently he was married. I think he had a daughter or maybe two children. And I just think that he's been driven mad on leftism and burned himself alive, died in a horrible way. And even when he did that, there were like non-whites on Twitter saying that they shouldn't use the phrase "rest in power" because he was a white male. And it was almost as if like his duty is to die for us to receive some kind of forgiveness for being a white male. And then the other kind of thing was that I saw takes going around like, oh, well, you know, right-wingers or conservatives, they don't understand the idea of self-sacrifice. And I just thought this is also stupid. This is this kind of third worldist nonsense that I was talking about earlier, which is weird because you begin to get the far-left ideas begin to manifest on the far right, and I just find it toxic. And here we are, like, what is it, like a week or 10 days after? And it's nobody speaking about it. Nobody cares about it. And it's because we live in he isn't the Chinese man who stood with a flag or whatever at Tiananmen Square in front of the tanks. Like, people want it to be like that, but it isn't. And I think the reason it isn't is because we are just completely saturated with imagery of all kinds of crazy stuff every day. Another issue is that because everything's so political and everything's so divided, that it isn't actually possible for it to become an iconic image. And somebody said to me the other day, like, could you think of any iconic images over the past 10 years or something? And I thought, well, one that comes to my mind would be the Sky King, you know, the one who went up in the airplane, Rich something, and he did this barrel roll in an airplane, and there was this little moment when he said, "Why I think it was the air traffic control, or why didn't you come down there? You're really good at flying. You never know what kind of a future you've got." And he responded over the radio, like, "Yeah, well, I'm just a white guy," as if to say, "Well, I've got no chances. I've got no luck. The system's just treating me like shit. So there'll be a diversity hire gets the job." And so you had all these moments coming together, this whole kind of last Faustian drive for greatness, which was in his soul, which has been crushed by this horrible system. But of course, I'm biased, and I am going to see that those things in it. Whereas if you said to a leftist, what was the most iconic image of the last 10 years or so, they'd probably say something like that little Syrian boy that washed up on the beach in Turkey that sparked the migrant refugee crisis in 2015, which was propagandized. Like, there's not really any common ground where everybody can sit back and see the one of those monks in Vietnam burning alive and think, yeah, that is just objectively a sacrifice. It's something it's not wonderful, but it's powerful. And I don't think you can do that when you're saturated with images, like, thousands of times per day you're seeing a different image. But then on top of that, you're just completely politically divided.
Yeah, I understand why people find something like this inspiring. I do think that it takes guts to kill yourself in a horrible way. But it's totally wrong what he did. He did. Okay. In a certain context, that could be the right thing. And in a certain context, I would applaud somebody doing that thing. However, this was not the context, and this was not the right thing. He did the right, or if he did the right thing, he did the right thing for the wrong reasons. He did the right thing for the wrong people and the wrong reasons. And therefore, it's a terrible treason to the right, to the, what's correct, what's moral, what's good. He was doing this for others. He was doing this for non-whites, and he was doing this out of white guilt. And that's wrong. It was a waste of life. Now, there are a lot of people are talking about, he was a terrible shit lib and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, this is true. I'm not gonna say he deserved to die over that or mock his death for that. I will say that he did something that required a certain amount of courage, if courage in the physical sense. He certainly had some admirable moral qualities, but they were all mixed up. And therefore, I can't give him any kind of real admiration or full-hearted admiration. I wish that this guy had grown up in a better society where he was not going around feeling all this white guilt and where it would be perfectly possible for him, and indeed, I think it's morally obligatory for white people to say it's outrageous that what's being done in our name with our money by these Jews in Israel. But we're not going to burn ourselves up over this. We're going to change our system. And if everybody who felt righteous indignation about the betrayal of America, basically by its leadership to be a servant of Israel and an enabler of genocide and evil in the Middle East, if everybody who did that burned themselves alive, well, I mean, there would be no possibility of change. So I just can't get enthusiastic about this. And the people in our circles who got enthusiastic about it, some of them have their points. I'm not going to say that they don't have an argument to be made, but a lot of them are sort of third worldist types. And again, I think it's perfectly reasonable and legitimate to, as a matter of principle, to say that I believe that all the peoples of the world deserve their own homelands. I can sympathize with stateless peoples around the world. And saying that, doesn't cost me anything, right? Well, it does cost me a lot, actually, because actually advocating ethno-nationalism costs you a lot. It's not cheap talk. I was just talking about how one of our apps was Cash App deplatformed us this past week, right? So what am I saying? Talk is cheap. But the point is that I'm doing just fine standing up for this. I can do this, and I can do this without any reciprocity in the real world from anybody in the third world. I'm standing up for my principles, and they don't have to reciprocate for me to stand up for my principles. When I think that something is right, I don't need an additional incentive to stand up for what's right. So I never have this line of reasoning. I know this is the right thing, but what's in it for me? I just don't think that way. I think that's just a reflects moral confusion to think that way, superficiality or immaturity. And so I don't have to have these people reciprocating in order for me to take a stand for them in the moral realm. But I sure as hell am not going to expend any more capital than I already have unless I get actual in-kind reciprocity from these people. And I see no signs of that coming. There have been people in the right for now generations who have been pining for some Arab oil money to come our way, or pining for some Gazprom rubles to come their way. And I don't think it's ever happened. I don't think we're going to get patronage from the Chinese or from the Arabs or from the Russians. And simping for that is just kind of foolish on our part. Or shaping and changing our messages in the hope that we can get that is crazy. So I'm not 100% against. There are people who will say, oh, if you believe that the Palestinians need a homeland, you're one of these third worldists who's going around making these offers to other people. Well, on some level that's true, but I don't see there's any problem with just taking a consistent moral stand on geopolitics. But I do recognize that, yeah, I'm not going to lift my finger for these people in any other way than that. I'll wag my tongue, but I'm not going to lift my finger unless there's actual real reciprocity. And I see none of that coming our way from the third world, sadly.
It's what I find a lot is that there's something Machiavellian hiding behind a noble sounding principle a lot of the time in our circle. So, I mean, there's people in the nationalist scene who have got more sympathy for the Palestinians than they do for the Ukrainians, or for that matter, the Tibetans. And yet the principle seems to start. In the case of the Ukrainians, they're actively on the side of Putin. Hang on a minute. So on the one hand, you've taken one stance on the Palestinians, and then on the other hand, you've taken something completely different on the situation in Ukraine. Again, or a complete indifference to what the Chinese do in Tibet. But the claim is that it is a sound sort of universal principle. But in actual fact, it's really just because they view, let's say, Zionists. I'm in England, I've got to watch for the hate speech laws. Let's just say the people who rule Israel, that elite, they see them as their principal enemy. And I think, just be honest about it and say that. That's fair enough. But don't then sort of dress it up in some kind of universal thing, universal struggle, when the very next day you'll be speaking, have a completely different take about a different part of the world. Really, it's just because that your enemies are in a bit of a sticky situation there, and you're going to take the position which will undermine them the most, which I can completely understand. But don't pretend that it's because you're sort of so worried about those people when you're not worried about other people, other ethnic groups who are suffering elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, this is true. There are some people where basically everything is about that tribe, and not everything is about them in this world. Thank God not everything is about them. Not yet. Only in their own heads is everything about them. This is another question that is related to leftist forms of protest, like Aaron Bushnell. But before we go into that, actually, I just saw that Endeavor is joining us. Endeavor, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Hello. Yeah. Thanks for dropping in. So Kathy has written in, and she has the question, why get upset about an attack on Lord Balfour's portrait, FFS?
Oh, God.
Well, I got upset about the attack on Lord Balfour's portrait, but yeah, you did too, Endeavor. And so why don't you go first, and then we'll bring Morgoth on, and then I'll share some of my thoughts on this. Just for the context, folks, if you haven't seen it, it was all over Twitter. Some leftist pro-Palestinian in the UK took spray paint and a knife and slashed up a portrait, I believe at Cambridge University, of Lord Balfour, who's known for the Balfour Declaration, which, of course, was a nefarious historical document. It was part of a quid pro quo, basically, to the Zionist movement. The Zionists would deliver the United States into the First World War in exchange for a British commitment to giving them a homeland in what was then Palestine. Absolutely nefarious from the point of view of America. We lost more than 200,000 men in that war. That was a small price to pay for Israel. And of course, there have been all kinds of terrible problems since then. But anyway, that's the background. So this portrait had to be slashed and spray painted. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, even if we are to decide that this is that Lord Balfour is not someone that we want to honor, it should be us making this decision as the people in control of our own countries and in control of our own elite institutions. The idea that we're just going to allow some anti-white leftist to just go on this iconoclasm against our artwork that belongs to an elite institution that's supposed to be a safeguard of our civilization, even though in these universities these universities are basically just designed to construct ideas that are designed to deconstruct our civilization. So, it's just outrageous that this person's allowed to get away with this thing, that you're just allowed to barge in and destroy a piece of artwork like that. Secondly, I mean, what are these people doing this for? Are they doing it because they're upset that Lord Balfour made this deal with the Zionists several century ago and that he got the United States into the war with, well, he at least attempted to get the United States into the war with Germany, which eventually they did get into. Are they protesting this or the fact that Lord Balfour made this deal? Or are they protesting the fact that they perceive Israel to be incorrectly? They perceive it to be this racist, white supremacist, colonialist, settler colonial society, just like they accuse all white countries of being. These people are not our friends. They are our enemies in every sense of the way. Same with this moron. What was his name? I even forgot the name. The guy that lit himself on fire 2 weeks ago. And I'm glad that I forgot his name because he was an anti-white loser who I think just made the world a better place by ridding us of his stupidity. And all I can say to these like Telegram neo-Nazis talking about how he took he hit a strike against Zog. Well, if they think that, well, then I think they should follow in his lead, not because that's actually going to fight back against Zog, but because they will benefit us by ridding us of their stupidity. Now, of course, I'm being facetious here. Don't actually do that. But like this pro-Palestine movement, there are enemies just as much as any Zionist. They're as anti-white as any crazy libtard, as any crazy BLM activist, as any crazy Jewish academic. These like the idea that they're our friends because they don't like the state of Israel, it's totally moronic, and it's just born out of this political bankruptcy. It's just about people that are just so desperate to have any kind of political victory that they consider some like anti-white creep who also just happens to not like Israel go basically doing something idiotic like this, some kind of political victory. So I just totally reject all these ideas. And even if Lord Balfour, you know, we could have that discussion. Is he a figure that we want to honor, or was he a negative figure? But it should be us having that discussion, and it should be us making this decision for our society, not some crazed anti-white leftists.
Yeah, absolutely. What about you, Morgoth? What are your thoughts on this Balfour gesture?
Well, I just the sight of seeing some lefty woman just tearing an old painting apart like that, I don't like it. I don't really care who it was in the painting. If it's there and it's a fine piece of work and it's in this hallowed institution, because this is part of a trend as well. They're wrecking stuff all over the place. And really, it comes down to a little bit what Endeavor was saying, and it gets back to this sort of obsession and this worship of the third world, or the global south, as they're calling it, even though like that includes like China and Russia and all these places, seemingly. Where is it that they are against Zog? Because that's what the sort of the nationalist or the people on the right who are sympathetic is, that's what they're betting the farm on. That an actual fact, they're just against Zog and our elites, and they will help facilitate a situation where they get replaced, and somehow that's going to bring us to power. But is that the case, or is it that they are actually against Western civilization, Europeans in general? Because I think it's that one. I think they are again. I think this is why Putin talks about Anglo-Saxons. in his speeches. I think they see it in as a civilizational struggle, not just a matter of the West has got bad elites. And when you drill down into a lot of the critical race theory stuff, it is that. It is talking about that. This is why they will say things like trains or white supremacy or maths is white supremacy or all of these things which have been imposed on them and sort of destroyed their being, their world picture, all of this sort of Western European intrusion through all of their technology, for all of our technology and money systems and imperialism. They regard Western civilization itself as something which has to be done away with. And they'll probably hate the idea of singling out one particular ethnic group who runs it or who is very influential. They wouldn't like that at all. They're looking at this in a civilizational terms. So this is the obsession with, it wasn't so much that it was just who was in the painting. It was just the painting itself and the institution. I mean, I did a tweet yesterday that I think it's completely ridiculous that you've got these elitist institutions who are pumping out people who hate the culture and the civilization that created it. I think the leftists shouldn't be allowed to enjoy those kinds of aesthetics when they're out to tear it all down. They should go off somewhere and sit in a kind of empty steel room or something. That's where they should get their education and their brainwashing. That stuff belongs to be taught in a gulag or something, not in these elitist institutions. But it's this high European civilization is what they hate the most. It's certainly not this idea that they're just out to remove Zog, which is what so many people are betting the farm on.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, and with these leftist pro-Palestine supporters, they're not against Israel because its influence over the West is negative. They're not against the Jewish lobby because the Jewish lobby is anti-white and that they have these double standards, that they've maintained ethnocentrism for themselves but have denied it to us. They just want the same thing, but they want Israel to live by that standard as well. So basically, what the reason I can't stand either the pro-Palestine or the pro-Israel camp is because the real debate that's going on here is it globo homo for everyone except for Israel or globo homo for everyone including Israel? So when they're saying that Israel is white supremacist, which even though Jews aren't actually white, they're basically just saying that, well, the reason that they're against Israel is because it's not living up to the standards which are currently eroding Europe and North America, that are currently eroding the white world. They just want that applied to them. So, I mean, what real difference is there? Just some one far off country in the Middle East that they can have, whether they can have their little ethno state in the desert or they don't get that. Well, I mean, that doesn't really change much for us, because at the end of the day, both of these camps want to have globo homo for white countries, and they want to have us replaced in our own homelands. It's just that the only real debate that's going on here is whether or not Israel will actually be an exception to that. And it's just like, we can't win with either of these. These are both fundamentally our enemies.
Yeah, I agree. I was not particularly upset with the Lord Balfour. Yeah, he's not an admirable figure. From an American point of view, he's certainly not an admirable figure. But again, the way to deal with non-admirable figures is to, first of all, it should be us, as you put it. And we're going to be talking about this from our own point of view, taking our own side on these matters. And I am very much a cultural conservative. And I just deplore the destruction of art and history and books and things like that. I don't believe in book burning. I don't believe in iconoclasm. I don't believe in vandalism. I do believe that certain things, if there are problems with them, they should be removed from the public someday. When we win, all the statues of General Lee and people like that are going to go back up. The statues of George Floyd are going to come down. Martin Luther King is going to come down. All this politically correct humiliation that we are enduring with ugly art, all of that shit's coming down. Does that mean that I want it destroyed? No. I think what they did in Hungary is a very good model to follow. What they did in Hungary is they took all the hideous Soviet and communist era art out of the center of the city, and they put it in a park called Memento Park, I believe. And you can go there and you can wander around and you can see all of this stuff. It's a museum of Soviet style communist bad taste, basically. And I think that these things should be preserved. They're part of history. They should be preserved. Now, Lord Balfour was a problematic guy. My attitude would be keep the portrait up because it was a very fine portrait. It's quite impressive. But contextualize it, you know, with a little plaque next to it indicating what a bad white man Lord Balfour was, what a bad man he was for white people. And leave it because, again, it's part of our history. Now, these climate people who have attacked things like Botticelli and Leonardo da Vinci, these people should be killed. We should pass a law mandating the death penalty for defacing important cultural artifacts, and we should apply it swiftly and mercilessly to a few of these people. Their quiffs of blue hair, you know, those heads with those little blue quiffs will roll. And if you do this a few times, this behavior will stop. And the way I put it in a tweet is that these works of art are unique and rare. They are entrusted to us. They're not ours, right? They don't belong to us. We don't have the right to neglect them. We certainly don't have the right to destroy them in a snit. We are entrusted to these things, and we need to pass them on to the future. We are responsible. These things are rare. So many of these things have been lost due to wars and looting and accidents and so forth. We can't be sloppy about this. We can't afford to be sloppy and lackadaisical about this. We need to get very serious about this. And if a few of these protesters have to die so that we can preserve our cultural heritage, that's just fine because these things are rare and those people are a dime a dozen. There's no shortage of these people. There's only one Mona Lisa. There's only one Birth of Venus. There's only one Primavera. And we should be very, very serious about this. So yeah, I would support institutionalizing the death penalty for these people. And it's not like there's going to be any question about whether they, you know, if they're really guilty, because they proudly film themselves doing this. It makes me so angry. I think that if I were in an art museum and I saw this happening, I would not be able to restrain myself. I would beat the living shit out of somebody who was trying to do this. And I wish more people would get a little, you know, they're being awfully polite about this. And it absolutely baffles my mind. Why are these people not being restrained? Why are these people not being tackled and brutalized for this disgusting behavior? Well, is this being tolerated by the museums?
Well, I don't know about the recent one with Lord Balfour, but there is a theory that a lot of these are actually staged. And I tend to think that's probably the case because the people that engage in this don't seem to actually be afraid of any kind of legal consequences. And from what I know, I don't see any of them actually being actually thrown the book at. And also a lot of the Balfour painting, it looks like, at least from the video, that it actually was destroyed. But a lot of times there's a protective glass in front of the painting, which, okay, that's good that the painting isn't actually being destroyed, but there is still a lot wrong with it. It's the message that's being sent, this kind of destructive nihilism that because this painting, something like the Mona Lisa, some person a couple months ago threw a can of soup at the Mona Lisa, one of these idiot climate protesters, but there was a protective glass. But just the act itself, like this act of like nihilistic destruction, that because something like the Mona Lisa exists, something which is the very opposite of nihilism that actually speaks to the soul. Because that exists, they want to destroy it because they believe in this anti-human, nihilistic, well, frankly, suicide cult, and they don't want something like that to exist. But then the other layer of that is that if, in fact, these are setups, if these are actually staged, well, it says something even worse about the situation, about these protests. It's that the people who are entrusted with these works are actually engaging in stuff like this. So if it's true that this demonstration at the Louvre was staged, that like this person throwing the can of soup on the Mona Lisa, even though it was actually protected, well, that means that the Louvre is actually endorsing this kind of thing. Now, they're not actually going to allow that piece of art to be destroyed, at least not yet. But, well, what does it say about who's in charge of an art gallery, which is supposed to protect the most valuable artistic masterpieces of our civilization? And, well, I guess that if that is in fact true, well, a lot of parallels can be drawn to the people that are in charge of our countries as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a bit of an extremist on this, I'm afraid. But again, you have to draw the line, and there's nothing more final and more terrifying to some people than the prospect of swift and sure capital punishment. And I think that should be imposed in these cases. And you'd only have to do it a few times, just like you'd only have to sink a few refugee boats before people would stop coming or stop trying to vandalize these works of art. They would come up with other ways protesting, but, you know, keep it out of the museums, keep their grubby hands off our culture and our heritage. There are other ways that you can express yourself. It simply has to be done. It simply has to be done just a couple of times, and then this craziness will stop. And having, you know, special exemptions for art that we don't like politically is not the way to do this. We should just have a blanket, very, very serious ban on this kind of stuff. And again, if one day when white people are in charge of white nations again, and we want to clean up our streets, we will remove these works of art that are basically humiliation rituals, right? But we won't destroy them. We'll simply put them in a museum somewhere, give them a new context, and let people go there and look at them if they so desire. I think that's the fair way of going about
this. Yeah, I mean, what I was thinking of is I was thinking, okay, so I don't like the idea of destroying these old works of art, even if it's somebody like Balfour or whatever. And I was thinking, well, what if it was Tony Blair? And I thought I still would probably wouldn't, so, like a painting of grinning Tony Blair as he opened up the floodgates of immigration in 1997 or something. And I actually like Greg's idea that, yeah, what you do is you leave it there, and then you put a plaque next to it, sort of damning him forever and saying this is one of the greatest traitors in the history of Britain, with a brief few paragraphs detailing just the scale of his treachery. And that's fine. Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Well, I think I mentioned on this show before a couple of years back about the question of what would we do with these anti-white movies which are made today if we took power in some future. What would we do with these works? Would we destroy them? And what I said was what I would do to them is something similar to what the Tribe and the anti-whites have done with movies like Birth of a Nation or Triumph of the Will. So they hold these things up as like horrible examples of the deep-seated evil racism in every European person. That's what they use films like Triumph of the Will or Birth of the Nation of a Nation for today. They use it kind of as like this counter propaganda, as like a demonstration. Well, I would probably do the same thing. So with movies like Django Unchained or Schindler's List or, you know, Get Out or something like that, what I would do is I would preserve these and I would show them what an anti the works that an anti-white society produced. I would use them as examples of why we can never allow our enemies to get power over us ever again. And I'd probably do the same with these hideous postmodern eyesores, which are basically made to just insult your senses these days. I'd put them in a museum and then I'd say, like, this is maybe the museum of garbage art. So, you know, this is what garbage looks like. And this is what a civilized. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, it's funny because it's such as what we were talking about before. So what you create is a before and an after, and you remind people forever about how horrible the before was. And it kind of gets us all the way back to June and something like the Butlerian Jihad, where the anti-white critical race theory, mass immigration would become to us and our people what thinking machines have become to people it's an anathema. It's something which is just detested and seen as hellish. And it's coded and written into all of law and all of sort of ethics and stories. And people will be able to look at things from that era and say, yeah, this is how bad it was. This is how bad it got. We came so close to going out forever. And this is going to be a permanent reminder that we never get into that situation again.
Yeah, and that's what they've done with a lot of our work. So, you know, the left will have you believe that every white person who ever lived before the year of 1965 was this raging genocidal maniac who wished for like the death of every single non-white person. That's the image that they show of our history. That as it's like it's the before times in the current era. It's the one that where.
Yeah.
Before Martin Luther King came around and taught everyone how to be tolerant, well, every white person was just, they just had Adolf Hitler inside them and they were just burning with this searing hatred for every single poor black person out there. But, you know, of course, this is incorrect history. But yeah, we would have to do something similar and basically show, well, this is what it was like when our enemies controlled our civilization.
Back in 2018, I believe it was, I gave a speech in the Netherlands on freedom of speech. It's up at Countercurrents. And I think it's a pretty good talk. And I make a strong principle case for freedom of speech and not just a tactical case, a case for institutionalizing freedom of speech in our own societies that we would create in the future. And one of the things that I say there is that we can't give in to the tendency to want to censor the bad ideas that have gotten us here. In fact, we have to make sure that everybody knows about these ideas. But we have to make sure that these ideas will, of course, never be repeated. And the best way that they'll never be repeated is for people to be aware of them. There will always be aberrant and marginal personalities that will generate these horrible ideas again. And if your civilization has just been cleansed of all memory of these things, then these things can come back and these mimetic plagues can sweep through again. And the only way to prevent that from happening is to immunize people. And the only way to immunize people is to educate them about this stuff. So yeah, we should preserve the past, even the horrible past, elements of the horrible past that we are fighting against, as a kind of memento mori to remind people of what happened. And again, to inoculate people against accepting these ideas, because they will come back in new and mutated forms in every generation. There will be people who will think this kind of stuff, and therefore people have to be immune to it. Now, there is one thing that I'm going to draw the line at, though, and that is this hideous architecture that's been inflicted upon us. Fortunately, though, it turns out that most hideous post-war architecture, it's not very durable. The reinforced concrete stuff is not very durable. And probably by the middle of this century, most of this stuff will simply need to be torn down, you know, and replaced. It won't be structurally sound anymore. And so the ugly architecture that clutters up our cities, eventually that will disappear. And we just need to make sure that we replace it with something beautiful. So when today's Penn Station, which is one of the great eyesores in New York, is finally demolished, maybe we can rebuild the old Penn Station in its place. Things like that can happen in terms of architecture. But there's a level of architecture where it is very utilitarian. And it is the most exposed to the elements because it is actually all outdoors. It's not locked up in museums. And architecture cannot be, certain kinds of architecture cannot be maintained forever. And this brutalist post-war modern architecture doesn't seem like it will stand for more than 100 years. So that's something rather encouraging. And I certainly am not going to go out of my way or would not want a society, a white society, to go out of its way to make sure that this stuff survives for down through the centuries, like the Gothic cathedrals. But you know, aside from that, you know, more portable works of art that can be preserved for very long periods of time, I think we should preserve those. And we probably should keep at least one or two, at least pictures of bad architecture around to remind people of how brutally ugly our cities were. So I want to check and see here about a few more questions. Folks, we're running out of time. We got about 10 minutes left. So if you've got a couple of questions, be sure to chime in. Friedrich writes in with $10. Thank you. Greetings, Frankfurt am Main. Okay. 50% Muslim population is the first city in Germany to introduce Ramadan lighting, which seems it's going to cost the city more than what they paid for Christmas lights. Do you think there is a chance the system will stop doubling down in the near future? All the best. Well, I'll go first to Morgoth. What do you think about this? Do you think they're going to stop doubling down in the near future?
I don't see how the current system is sustainable. So I think they have to change, because as we've been discussing tonight, you've got a sizable proportion within the West that hate Western civilization. You've got an emerging sort of coalition outside of the West, which has a lot of clout, which also hates the West. And then you've got the actual ruling class of the West, and they hate it as well. And it seems to me that even if they just want to sort of stay in power, they have to change track. They have to dial this back to a certain degree, because the only people who seem to care about Western civilization is people like us. And it's not sustainable in the long run, unless it's just they're entirely nihilistic and they just want to see it all burn. I don't think that's true, though, even if for no other reason than their power, base of power, would also go. You know, if you're operating in a senior position in the American deep state, or you're writing for Chatham House or the Council of Foreign Relations, and you're in touch with people at the Federal Reserve or the Bank of England, that's a very nice position to be in. That's a very cozy little club they've got going, and I don't think they want to see that come down. What will happen if they don't try and sort this out is that they'll be replaced internally, because there's going to be so many people who have an incentive to prevent this going completely under. It seems to me that something will have to change. The direction of travel has to change, because it's unsustainable that everybody just hates a civilization, including the people who run it. I mean, that's a sort of rare optimistic take that I've got, is that in the long term, I just don't see this. From multiple angles, this is unsustainable. I think it'll change.
Endeavor?
Well, I wrote an article about this last year. It was called The Mother of All Sunk Cost Fallacies. So I think that the elites kind of are going to run into this sunk cost fallacy. So if anyone doesn't know what that means, it means like that you shouldn't consider the past expenditures you've put into a project when deciding how you're going to proceed. You should only consider the future gains that you could potentially get. So let's say, for example, you start a business and you lose $20,000 in 2 years. Well, you shouldn't consider you shouldn't take that $20,000 into consideration when you decide to continue the business. You should take into consideration whether it is actually potentially going to be profitable, because you can't, if you're going to try to stay in business with the intention of making that $20,000 back, well, you're just going to lose another $20,000 and then you're going to have an even bigger hole when you really should just cut your losses and then move on if that's the case. I think that a lot of them are going to have to ask themselves this kind of question, because a lot of the, now there are other aspects to this, but a lot of this is based on this kind of belief in this universalist, egalitarian, John Lennon's imagined Star Trek future, that a lot of the elites genuinely do believe that they're bringing this future about. Now, a lot of them are just these insane, crazy nihilists who want to see the world burn for their own resentment. But I can't imagine that all of them really are. Like someone, let's say Elon Musk, for example. Now, is he our guy? No, he isn't. He's not. Elon Musk is not a, well, let's just say, I don't think he has sympathies with what would be called the far right or the dissident right. I don't think Elon Musk necessarily sympathizes with us, but he's also not a true believer in this liberal universalist egalitarianism. I'd say he's kind of like a 90s liberal, which, you know, last generation's progressive. But he'd have to ask himself if Elon Musk actually wants to go to Mars. I think he actually does. I think he does want to see humanity take that step. Well, he'd have to ask himself, does he actually want that? Because if he does, then he'd actually have to take these problems seriously. So is he going to give up that his dream to take humanity to Mars because he would rather worship Africans and transsexuals instead? Because the policies that are in place right now, the law, it makes it mandatory that is put above any kind of competence. So for example, his company SpaceX was actually sued by, I think, the Justice Department in the U.S. I don't know exactly what department it was, but because they were not hiring enough refugees at SpaceX, they were actually sued. Now, you know, Musk, for example, would have to ask, well, you know, these laws that are already in place, these are going to rot my entire business empire from the inside out. And if I actually want to achieve my goals, I'd have to think about this. And Musk did share the article about Harold Robertson's article about the competency crisis, which the article basically is about the Civil Rights Act. So this is the richest man in the world sharing an article which basically says that the Civil Rights Act needs to be abolished if America wishes to continue to be a first world, a high quality of life country. Now, I'm just using Musk as an example here. I'm not saying that he's a savior or anything like that. He isn't. But you have to think that a lot of other people with money and influence will have to think along these lines as well. Do they really want to give up flying around the world on a private jet, eating Wagyu beef and caviar? Because, you know, because they can, you can't have that and have a society which is trying to make black transsexuals the pilots of all the airlines and the engineers of the airlines and the people running the airline, what's it called, the flight security deck on the airports. You'd have to ask yourself these questions. And if nothing else, you'd have to imagine they'd rather preserve that than just this stupid, idiotic ideology.
Yeah, I did a video a couple of years ago called Why Elon Musk Will Never Go to Mars and How He Could, which was pretty much like what you were saying there. But the issue is that this is beginning to, these kind of policies that are being forced, that it's law, are beginning to rankle a lot of very powerful people. Now, there's a take being going around that's something about the PayPal mafia, where you've got a lot of people in tech with a lot of muscle and a lot of connections are beginning to get really fed up with the way things are going. So it's nothing lasts forever, I suppose.
Or look at the fall of ESG as well. ESG is basically being discarded by a lot of the financial world. So even Larry Fink, you know, our arch enemy, I don't think that globalism necessarily has a final boss. But if Jewish power, globalism, all of this had a final boss, it would probably be Larry Fink. He even said that he's going to stop using the word ESG Not that he, not because he's actually changed his mind on any of this, but because the idea has gained such a negative reputation. People are sick of it. And ultimately it's because even if they actually do believe all the crazy idiotic beliefs that are behind, that ESG is based on, it's not profitable. You're not going to be able to run a profitable corporation with these while you're wasting so much money trying to be compliant with these ridiculous policies. So yeah, I am somewhat optimistic about that, but at the same time, I'm trying not to get too far ahead of myself. The other thing is that the militaries as well. Like almost every military, the United States, Canada, Britain, all of them are just in absolute turmoil and they're just totally useless. Like I've just seen in the last couple of weeks, I've read a couple articles about how the Canadian military is losing members. Its population is declining because absolutely no one wants to sign up. You know, Sam Francis wrote about this in his book when he talked about managerialism, the soft managerialism, which he described the West as. One thing he said was that their biggest weakness is that people don't actually want to sacrifice anything for it. It can only run based on narrative and based on giving kind of these incentives and offering hedonism. People won't fight and die for it, and they have almost no ability to actually coerce people into doing it. So, you know, the system is in trouble, and it doesn't even have anything to do with us. It more has things to do with the fact that it's just based on lies.
Well, I do agree that things can't go on forever. Nothing lasts forever, and unsustainable things can't be sustained forever, obviously. Even sustainable things can't be sustained forever. So what about unsustainable things? Obviously, their days are numbered. However, I'm a little worried that these people are not going to be able to pull us back from the brink for this reason. One of the things that was really driving wokeism a few years ago was, you know, elite overproduction and especially the enormous differences in life prospects between young, you know, members of the scribal elites that have been, you know, generated by our universities recently and people who are one or two generations older than them. And this became very, very clear during COVID when these people in the more recent elite echelons were living in their tiny apartments, their pods, basically. They were confined to pod all the time. And their bosses were taking helicopters to estates on Long Island. You know, these people were crushed by COVID lockdowns, whereas their bosses, older generations of the same basic type of people, were able to wait this out in relative comfort. And one of the things that was driving wokeism was just the desire of these resentful recent college graduates to unseat the people above them, unseat the establishment. And so how did they do this? Well, they scrolled through all of their social media and found them doing racisms or insensitive things. Most of these people aren't racist at all, but you can of course change the criteria of what constitutes racism. It's always changing, and therefore these people, you know, used to be very paid up and cutting edge liberals 20, 30 years ago, but times have changed, and so these people could be ejected. This happened in a lot of corporations, especially things that were more, you know, connected with media and publishing, the softer, leftier parts of the economy. This happened a lot. And the reason why these people were powerless against this is because they accept these moral standards, the moral standards that were being used to judge them. They accept these moral standards. We have an absolute hegemony of a moral system that basically says that the white ethnic preference is the worst possible thing in the world, that white people are responsible for all the ills of the other people in the world, that we can never take our own side, we need to hang our heads in shame, and on and on. And because this moral code is unchallenged, it can be used at any time by people who just want to use it as a weapon for personal advancement. And every moral code can be used that way, right? Every moral code can be used as a weapon for hypocritical, personal, non-moral ends. And this moral code is completely inconsistent with the survival of civilization itself. And yet, people are highly incentivized to use this as a tool of upward mobility within the system. And they have no incentive, individual incentives, to question this moral code or reject this moral code. The only thing that they can do is hope that the weapon always is in their hands and they're always using it against their enemies, but nobody picks up that knife and uses it against them. And once somebody elects to do that, they are utterly defenseless. And so I just don't see how, given the moral code that's in place and the essential cowardice of people to challenge it and the incentivization to wield it, that we're ever going to be able to put the brakes on woke until we change that moral code, until we reject that moral code. And yes, there are a lot of people who are saying, I want to be woke and go to Mars. And they're going to try and find some way of squaring that circle or evading that problem. And there are very few people, though, who will just reject the whole thing, root and branch. But that's what's got to be done. And so my fear is that as long as this moral outlook remains intact, and as long as people have incentives to use it for upward mobility, even though by so using it, they're causing the whole world to burn down, right? And as long as people are petrified against challenging it, this process is just going to go on. Now, it might go through cycles, and people might just get tired of it, right? They might get tired of the crime and chaos. They might hypocritically, sneakily try and return to certain forms of normality. But it's always going to be hypocritical and sneaky. And it's always going to be susceptible to somebody pointing at them and denouncing them, right? And getting this whole craze started again. And so my feeling is that, yes, it's unsustainable. And it might not be sustainable for very much longer. But I don't think there are going to be people, rational adults in the room, in positions of power, who are going to make the decision to put the woke away.
I don't think that's going to happen either.
Yeah, they're not going to do that. We're not going to have a technocratic solution where adults in the room decide to put the woke away. I fear that things are just going to have to get really, really bad so that the people who are in power are swept out of power. But then again, if power reconstitutes itself, but all you've done is reshuffle the elites and don't change this fundamental anti-white attitude, we're still going to be paying for Ramadan lights. You know, we'll just have Republicans paying for Ramadan lights or something like that. So it's problematic. I'm a long-term optimist, but I don't think we're going to get to the happy long-term without a great deal of tribulation, basically.
Yeah, but I mean, what I think is going to put the woke away, so to say, will be just reality. I don't see there being this kind of Machiavellian move on the part of the elites where they kind of just lull everyone back to sleep by, you know, giving us by putting away some of the anti-white propaganda, and instead of giving us movies where it's this obnoxious black guy who hates you for being white, it's just this kind of pleasant black guy again, like they had in the 1980s. I mean, the problem is that, well, all like that doesn't really change the actual issues on the ground. So because to actually change that, not that I want to go back to the 1990s, all the problems were already in place by then, and we need to be forward looking. But even doing that would be far, it would be far right. You'd have to step outside of the moral paradigm of the present time and the moral paradigm which existed back then. just in order to do that. And I can't see anybody actually, I can't see anyone actually doing that in order to put the woke away, so to say. So I think it's just going to be reality. I think it's just going to be that there will come a point when they realize, okay, we can't have that. We can't abide by this ideology and actually run a functional society at the same time.
I have one more question, and then we should wrap up because we've already gone over time. I will return to this question about Locke and managerialism in another stream, but I need to think about it a week or so before I get back to it. Board Troll has donated one lemon. Thank you. Dino has donated $3. The destruction of art, architecture, writings, etc. is why we have forgotten all of ancient history. We live in a confused limbo, and it still occurs, especially since World War II. Exactly. I don't want to get in the habit of destroying history. I think we need to preserve as much as we can, even preserve bad things, because preserving the memory of bad things helps us to not repeat it. So I want to go to a question here from Lovecraft's Cat. I just need to search around for it. Oh, okay, Lovecraft, I'm sorry, I can't find the exact words. The gist of it is this. Would we like to comment on Nathan Koffness's recent piece on the rights problem with being dumb? Spencer Quinn wrote something about this that we just published the other day. Koffness basically says that the right is less intelligent than the left. He cites one study that I think is kind of one-dimensional and dubious, but his main argument is simply this. When it comes to wokeism, and this is relevant to the conversation we've been having, when it comes to wokeism, the left is more consistent. They realize that, okay, if people are all basically equal, and if some groups continue to suffer and do badly in life, that can only be because of the malevolence of other groups. And therefore, we need to identify these malefactors and neutralize them and change the systems that are causing equal people to have unequal outcomes. That's basically the consistent argument of wokeism. And he says that there are a lot of people on the right, and I think he's thinking of Christopher Rufo and Richard Hanania, but he's not saying that he thinks they're less smart than him or less smart than leftists, who will not challenge that basic assumption of equality, right? People are equal, but they want to challenge wokeness. And he says that that's prima facie evidence that they're not as bright. They think, well, yes, people are all equal in some important sense. Maybe unequal outcomes are, maybe they think that they're inevitable, maybe not, but they certainly want to tiptoe around it. But what they want to do is they want to say, but trying to equalize these people is creating all kinds of terrible effects, and we just can't do this. And so we have to put the woke away. That's basically the argument. And my response to that is quite simple. To say that the leftists are being more intelligent is not the right word for it. What they are is they're one-dimensional and fanatical. The people on the right who say, yeah, okay, I basically believe in human equality and we're all created equal and the contents of our character, blah, blah, blah. But if you defund the police, it hurts everybody and it really hurts Black people too. Is that a stupid argument? No, it's actually an intelligent argument. But what it's doing is it's not challenging the bad ideas that generate the crisis of civilization, but it's simply saying that woke attempts to combat these are leading to terrible consequences and that we shouldn't be doing this. And therefore, we need to ease off. And so what's happening here is simply people are looking at consequences and they're doing a consequentialist analysis, basically. And they're saying, look, this is no way to run a society. Even though I won't challenge your basic assumptions, this is no way to run a society. Now, what Koffness wants people like Rufo and Hanania and a lot of other people to do is just say, look, people aren't equal. Reject the equality premise, which I wholly agree with. And he wants to talk about human biodiversity. I wholly agree with that. And that would be a better solution than just saying, well, we're going to just sort of shuffle uncomfortably when people talk about human equality and then point out that regretfully defunding the police and not punishing Black people makes society worse. I mean, that's not a stupid position, but there's a way of doing this better. But anyway, that's basically my thought about the argument that Kaufness has put forward.
He seems to be. I mean, I didn't read the article. I haven't followed this whole discussion. But it's as if Kaufness is daring them to cross the line. He knows they won't cross the line into the bad territory there, because
The thing that I loved about the Spencer Quinn article is he's basically saying, well, actually, the smart leftists are really the midwits. It's the old midwit meme, right? the bell curve meme, where you've got the smartest people and the dumbest people agreeing with one another again, and the wokists are the midwits in the middle of the bell curve, who are basically just kind of one dimensional thinkers, and they don't think about negative consequences. You know, they're totally shocked that when you basically give Black people a free pass to commit crimes, that crimes go through the roof. They're just totally shocked at that. Even though 70 IQ gangbangers understand the incentives and act accordingly, all of these supposedly smart college-educated liberal types are shocked that crime goes up when you give people a free pass to commit crimes. They simply are shocked by that. And the people who point this out, the Heather McDonalds of the world, they're not dumb. They're actually smarter than these midwit leftists. And Heather McDonald is a wonderful example of the kind of person that Kaufness is daring to cross the line. She's really great at chronicling all the negative effects of basically depolicing Black people that have happened since the beginning of BLM, since the days of Trayvon Martin. But she won't challenge the moral assumptions here. And he's just daring her to cross that line.
Oh, yeah. The way I would describe it, now I haven't read the article, so I can't comment on that directly. But the way I would put it is that wokeism, if that's the word we want to call it, this is basically the logical conclusion of incorrect foundational premises. So
Right. Let's
say, for instance, I believe that 1 + 1 = 3, and then I built a bridge based on that mathematics, like the bridge that I was building and all the physics and stuff involved with that. I'm not an engineer, by the way, if anyone's wondering. I know nothing about math or engineering or anything like that. But let's just say that I built this bridge under this false assumption. Well, here's the thing. Both the woke and the, I don't know, what do I call them, the normie conservatives, the people like Chris Rufo or whoever else this might apply to, Tim Pool, let's say. Well, their bridge wouldn't work even if this premise was correct, their bridge still wouldn't work. The woke, their bridge would actually work if this foundational premise was correct, but it isn't. So what I'm saying is that if we believe that people are fundamentally equal, if we believe that there is no, if there is no biological determinism for humans, that issues, things like race and also gender as well, maybe some of these guys would accept the gender issue, but they won't with race. If we were to accept that there is absolutely no difference and that people are just interchangeable and that it's all environmental and it's all about upbringing, it's all nurture and absolutely no nature, well, then how do you explain the differences? Well, then there has to be some other explanation, because it is still true that Black people, for example, attain lower grades in education, commit more crime, make less money on average than white people do. Well, you have to have some kind of explanation for that. But if you're starting from this assumption that everyone is equal and there is absolutely no biological determinism, well, then people come up with these crazy ideas like institutional racism or whiteness or white privilege or whatever other nonsense they'll spit out these days. These ideas are meant to explain why this foundational premise is not actually bearing itself out in reality. So in order to actually push back against that, you have to reject that foundational premise of absolute equality. Because if you don't do that, well, then you don't really have any way to respond to the woke, to the anti-whites, because eventually they're just going to say, well, then why don't we have equality? And they'll have, and then people like Christopher Arufo or Tim Pool, or I don't know what Sargon believes today, but I remember back in 2017 or so, he was making these arguments on YouTube. They have no arguments against that. So yeah, you have to reject that false premise at its root, because if you don't do that, well, then it's like building a bridge. When you believe 1 + 1 = 3, your bridge is going to collapse because the foundations it's based upon are incorrect.
Yeah. Morgoth, do you have any more thoughts on this?
Yeah, I was just listening to Endeavor thinking. So basically, you have this, you have a problem here, and the solution, one of the solutions on offer, is in this sort of sumptuous area with comfortable cushions and a banquet on the table. And then there's a kind of half and half where you're standing in the corridor. But then there's another explanation for what's happened. It's just that that's like surrounded with minefields and barbed wire. So the social costs for going there are catastrophic, and you'll be booed out of polite society. And in England, you'd probably go to jail. And of course, Kofnas, as it seems to me, is saying, yeah, that's where the all explanation to be consistent is out there in the minefield, and it's up to you to go and get it. Are you going to go do it? And these people are trying to squirm and hang around in this sort of limbo where they're going to say, well, it's not that cut and dried. And in the end, the main incentive is to just go along, like what you were saying earlier, with the incentive structure to get ahead.
Yeah, I have to say that I was very annoyed with Kofnas's rhetoric when he was going after Kevin MacDonald a few years ago. And I thought that there were problems with his criticisms of MacDonald and so on. And there are many annoying, snarky things with his rhetoric in this particular article. He really does have a contemptuous attitude for ordinary white people, and that's hard for me to stand. But he's being very courageous about standing up for human biodiversity, biologically based inequality, and he's been doing it at Cambridge, and he's under a lot of fire. And I have to respect him for that. He's Jewish. He's got his particular agenda. He's got a certain hostility towards white nationalist types, and especially white nationalists who talk about the JQ. However, he's doing something very important. I don't know how long he's going to be able to keep his platform. I know he's resigned from certain responsibilities at Cambridge, but I hope that he holds on, and I hope that he keeps doing this. In the same way that I like the things that Amy Wax has been doing at University of Pennsylvania, another Jewish academic who stood out and talked about, well, basically biological race differences and wokeism as well. And she's being censured by her administration. She's a tenured professor. They can't get rid of her, but they're trying to make her very uncomfortable. If Jewish academics want to use some of their capital to advance controversial theses that we agree with and that we can build upon, I applaud that. I really, really appreciate that. They could be doing a whole lot of other stuff that's highly rewarded but bad for white people, and they've chosen a different route. So I respect Kofnas for what he's doing in this particular case. And I think that he's actually being quite courageous, and this is a good thing. And I wish him the best. So we are way over time. So let me just read a couple last little chats here. Dino writes in with $4. Wait, well, there's more. MI5 surveillance van writes with $10. Leftism, equality, fairness, safety is feminine. right is masculine broadly. He adds $5 and says leftism is broadly feminine in its values. I can agree with that. Dino writes in with $4. He says the pursuit of excellence is a very Western ideal. It appears to be not just unfashionable, but actively discouraged, even condemned. Somebody in the chat mentions that, well, excellence is definitely something you see in some of the Asian civilizations as well. Spartan Sardaukar has donated 2 lemons and 2 more lemons. And so that basically wraps up all of our super chats. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me. This has been a really, really good discussion. Well, before we go, Morgoth, tell people how they can follow your work.
Morgoth's Review on Substack and on YouTube.
Wonderful. And Endeavor, how do people follow your work as well?
YouTube, Substack, Twitter, and Telegram, and a few of my articles are also appearing on Countercurrents now.
Yes, yes, we're very pleased with that. So folks, we don't know who our guest will be next week on Countercurrents Radio. There are many, many stories developing, so these things will shake out in time, in good time. But we will be back a week from now. The first live stream of April will be our book club, and that will be on my book, Against Imperialism. I hope you will join us for that, and I hope you will come prepared. So pick up the book, get Against Imperialism. You can get it through Amazon for now, and other booksellers online. You can order it directly from Countercurrents as well. And we will let you know in due time about who our guest is for the next session. I want to thank you all for joining us. We've had almost 200 listeners for the duration. Thank you, Morgoth. Thank you, Endeavor. Thanks to our donors. Thanks to our moderators. We will be back. And until then, keep reading Countercurrents. Thank you.